From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire likes to think of itself as a beacon of civic health. We have good voter turnout, a huge citizen legislature, town meetings, and our grassroots presidential primary. But along with these strengths, there are some weaknesses, according to the latest state civic health index, including some areas where New Hampshire ranks near the bottom of the country. And bolstering civic health isn't just some feel-good exercise. Communities with social trust, volunteering, and connection across differences are likely to have stronger economies and healthier populations. So today in The Exchange, it's a checkup on our state's civic health. And listeners, let's hear from you. How do you think New Hampshire is doing in this area? And where could we do better? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number, 800-892-6477. Our guests are Kihata Moore-Vissing. She's a fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy at UNH and co-author of the 2020 New Hampshire Civic Health Index. Also with us, Dick Ober. He's president and CEO of the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation. Well, welcome to both of you. And Kihata, just to start off with some definitions first, please. What is civic health?
Thanks for having me, Laura. So civic health looks at the overall quality of civic life and local democracy in a given community. So it's really about how much people feel their voices are heard, how responsive they feel elected officials are to their needs, how connected they feel to others in their community. And I'm glad you use this metaphor of checkups, because I think it's easiest to understand civic health by comparing it to our physical health. So when someone asks us, you know, how's your health? How are you doing? We usually assess our physical health by looking at a range of factors. So we think, you know, how's my knee? How's my asthma? How are my migraines? But with civic health, we're rather than looking at our, you know, our knee or our migraines, we're looking at factors like how much are people talking to their neighbors? How much do they trust government? Are they talking with their public officials? Are they reading the news, voting, volunteering? Do they feel like they matter to their communities? And when we look at all these factors together, that tells us if our community is healthy civically or if there are some challenges that we need to address.
So how does this index, and we should say, you know, this happens in many, many other states, and this has happened in New Hampshire before. How does the index specifically measure these things, Kihata? You know, some I can see. Voting, that's a data point. You can grab it. But others like, is your voice heard? How do you feel about your local officials? How do you measure that stuff?
It's a great question. So I can answer it two ways. I can tell you the way that we measured it in the 2020 index, and I can also tell you some other ways that I'd like to measure it in the future. So in the 2020 index, we used survey data to inform this, and we used two data sources. One was the US Census current population survey. Every couple of years does a civic supplement where they look at things like how much people are connecting with their neighbors, how much they interact with people of a different race or ethnicity than themselves, how much they're voting, volunteering. So there's you know, probably like 25 different indicators that they look at around civic health outcomes, all of which are in our report. My co-author, Bruce Mallory, and I at University of New Hampshire, we ended up feeling like, you know, the census data is very helpful in understanding civic health, but it doesn't paint a sufficient enough picture because it doesn't show us about how people are feeling, levels of trust. And so we actually drew upon another survey to look at some of those things and ran that through the University of New Hampshire Granite State poll. So we actually had two data sources for the Civic Health Index. What I would like to do in follow-up data is actually do some qualitative research where we start interviewing people in communities, we drill down to experiences at the community level, because the civic health data that we have is really only at the state level. So I think there's more work to do to understand the nuance of civic health in New Hampshire. But basically the way that we've measured it so far is through this survey data and through looking at other, you know, reports in the state that shared information about what civic life looks like and drawing off those data sources.
And let's just be clear, Kihata, before we go any further, this data was gathered before the pandemic. So who knows how the pandemic is going to affect civic health? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So I, you know, I, Dick and I can probably share some theories about that today of how we think that some of this data might be changed by the pandemic, but this data were collected from 2017 to 2019. So it shows us, it's actually helpful. It shows us a baseline of what civic life looked like before the pandemic. It may be a place that we want to work ourselves back to over time if we end up finding that the pandemic has harmed our civic life. But right now we don't have information except anecdotal about how the pandemic has affected civic health.
So Dick Ober, broadly, what's at stake here with civic health?
Thank you, Laura, for having me on. And I really want to thank Yada and Bruce and Carsey. This is a really important contribution. It kind of sounds wonky, but it's not. It's good old common sense. The way we look at is that civic health is foundational to every issue. No matter what you care about, our ability to engage and solve problems together is based on this concept of civic engagement and our civic health. And as you said, it's also a long-held New Hampshire value. We pride ourselves as a state on being informed, on our ability in the past to be able to disagree but try to find common ground. We tend to be pretty engaged at the local level in our communities and town boards and nonprofits. Many towns still practice town meeting. So it's important because it's critical to every issue we care about, and it is a New Hampshire value. And then frankly, we see some of that eroding. The report shows some of that, and we can all just feel it kind of in the atmospherics of civil discourse and polarization, kind of more harsh rhetoric than we're used to. This report, as Kiata said, shows we're doing well in some areas. We should continue to strengthen those, but not so well in some others.
What's the connection, Dick, between economic health and civic health?
So let me give you one interesting example, and this goes into the report a little bit. So there's some paradoxes in this report where we can do very well on average, but then you dig down and you find some gaps that also have some oddly positive things. So an example, and Quijada will correct me on any of this data, but one of the things the reports tell us is that people with lower incomes are actually more likely to discuss politics and issues with their neighbors. They're more likely to help out their neighbors, but they're less likely to vote in national elections. There also is some real, on the individual family economic level, we know that some of the barriers to more civic engagement, voting, volunteering, showing up at local meetings, is related to, do you have the ability from your job to be a little flexible to do that? Is there good childcare? Do you have transportation? So there's some personal family economic issues that are directly related to people's ability to engage. And we think those are barriers that we can lower.
Transportation, childcare, I know that came up a lot for people. In terms of why they weren't more civically engaged. Quijada, I'm interested to you too, you know, the benefits economically to the community at large or to the individual. Let's take that first, Quijada. What's the benefit to me if I do decide to connect more with people in my wider community, if I do decide to sort of reach across the aisle and connect with people who may think differently from me? How do I benefit from that?
I think people really benefit in a range of ways. So at the individual level, people who feel connected in their communities are generally more supported. And so we saw this play out during the pandemic where communities with stronger social networks were able to be more responsive and more resilient to the pandemic when it started and over time. So an example of that, a very simple example is at the individual level, if I'm someone who's immune compromised or you know, of an older demographic and felt like I couldn't access the grocery store or go to the pharmacy when the pandemic hit. You know, if I have social connections, if I have neighbors, if I have other people looking out for me, then you know, I do better during this moment than people who are socially isolated. Another factor that we see, which I think is really interesting when we think about the national epidemic that we've been experiencing for some time around mental health, is that feelings of belonging and connectedness are connected with civic health, right? When we feel like we matter to our communities, where people, we feel like people know us, where we feel like our public officials are listening to our needs and being responsive, you know, we feel more connected and welcome in our communities. And the inverse of that is that when we don't, when we feel socially isolated, that's been identified as one of the new killers actually in our society. So there was a study by Cigna a few years ago that showed that isolation is as deadly as smoking a pack of cigarettes a day. So I think there's some individual benefits to civic health. The other thing that I would say is really policy. So if you're not voting and you're not connecting with your public officials or attending public meetings, you know, your voice is essentially not being heard or represented in policy, and that then affects your experience, right, and affects your reality. So there's just a range of needs around individual civic health.
Wow, I'm really struck by what you say. Stronger civic health can mean better physical and mental health for the people living in that community, Kihara.
That's right.
And one of my listeners, go ahead, Kihara, yeah.
Oh, I was gonna say, we also see that you know, civic health corresponds to public safety and corresponds to the local economy, as Dick was mentioning.
Oh, talk about that a little bit more, Kihara, that's interesting. So stronger civic health also means a safer community and a stronger economy for that community.
That's right. So I think a really tangible example, I'm just thinking of what we've been through in the past year, is that when we think about that moment where communities had to local businesses had to pivot from doing business as usual to doing business during a pandemic, I think local businesses that had a culture of volunteerism surrounding them or other social networks were able to make that transition more quickly, keep their businesses afloat. And you saw, I mean, one thing that I thought was overwhelmingly beautiful in my community is seeing the commitment of people in a community to, you know, buying gift certificates ahead at restaurants and trying to pay it forward so that businesses didn't go underwater. So that's just one very tangible example. And I think that we also see public safety just in terms of people looking out for each other, people reporting if they're seeing, you know, they're noticing like something looks different at my neighbor's house and I don't know if that person's okay. So you know, there's really just a range of benefits that come from civic health. I see it at the core of a lot of the other social issues that we're navigating today.
We've got already some listener comments coming in, and I want to remind everybody that we are talking about New Hampshire's civic health today in the Exchange. Let's hear from you, listeners. How would you rate New Hampshire's civic health on a scale of 1 to 10? What do you see in your own community around this? Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook if you'd like, or give us a call, 800-892-6477. Here's an email from Nancy who says, I am often disheartened by how many people pass me on the sidewalk without a nod, a smile, a hello. More often than not, people walk by with earbuds in, don't look up or acknowledge other people at all. It's a small thing, Nancy says, perhaps, but to me, acknowledging people in one's community seems like a fundamental part of civic health. Nancy, thank you for writing. Laura on Facebook says, I'm an educator in New Hampshire, and I've been wondering, it seems like part of the issue with civic health is around education. How much people know about the opportunities in their community, or how discerning they can be about news sources. Laura asks, how does education play a role in strengthening civic health? Laura, great question. And Dick Ober, I'll throw that to you.
Sure. So what the report confirms is that education is one of the best predictors of civic engagement. And good news. New Hampshire people are relatively well-educated, which does tend to lead to more civic engagement. But the quality of that public education is going to vary fairly substantially, K-12 system, depending on what district you are in and your children are in. And that's connected to the way that we think about public education and support it. There's also a real effort around specifically civics education. As the curriculums have been tightened around the country and around the state, civics education is not an automatic part of the K-12 experience. Some districts are doing more of it than others. This is where there's actually some great nonprofits kind of stepping into that. There is the New Hampshire Institute for Civics Education, short is just NH Civics, which is working in the K-12 system, including a great program for middle schoolers to have more kind of healthy conversations across their difference and doing that early on. Kiata, I think I'm right in saying education may be one of the single best predictors of how engaged and how welcomed and involved someone feels.
Go ahead, yes, Kiata.
Right. Yeah, that's right. It's such an important question, the education question. So as Dick mentioned, we saw overwhelmingly of all the civic health indicators from both of those surveys that we ran, education was the variable that had the most relationship with stronger civic health outcomes. And so I think that implicates policy in New Hampshire in a number of ways where we you know, have to think about funding for our K-12 institutions and the access to affordable higher education, which has been a continued challenge in New Hampshire in particular, because we are seeing, I mean, what I find fascinating about the civic health data is a lot of the time education outcomes and income outcomes are linked, right? So there's an intersection between those things where if you see that someone has a lower income and a lower educational level, they might struggle on other certain social outcomes. That's not the case with civic health. Education does make a difference, but income, we see people at all different kinds of income levels that demonstrating strong civic health outcomes. As Dick had mentioned before, so, you know, for instance, lower income people are the most likely to help out their neighbors of any other income group. And so I think that I find that really interesting because what it tells us is that focusing on education is what will make the difference.
Let's go to our listeners. And again, our number is 800-892-6477. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Join us with your thoughts, comments, personal experiences with this idea of civic health in your community. And Dick and Kiata, Stephen's calling from Rye. Hi, Stephen. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Go ahead.
So what, you know, everyone was just talking about, I came to the conclusion that this was the problem about 20 years ago. So really the question isn't whether it's happening or not. It's what we can be doing about it. And, you know, as an engineer, I'm not political, but I just needed to solve the problem. So a couple of things that I do is, one is we have the Rye Civic Week. And, you know, Kiata talked about, well, the newspapers and people talking to each other. First of all, the newspapers are dying. They don't even, they can't cover things at the local level like things used 20, 30, 40 years ago. And as you mentioned, people just aren't comfortable talking politics, obviously driven by the polarization. So the key thing, even if you get people to show up to vote or show up to town meetings, if they're not educated and informed, then how can they participate? So the Civic League actually puts together a monthly email that puts things in short, digestible pieces. What happened at select board? What's going on at planning? And then links to that information. So about half the people that get the Civic News open it, anywhere between 30 and 40% of those people that open those links click on at least one thing. If you moved into Rye or you moved into a town, you moved to a city, how do you know how that community works, how the government works? It's not written down. Who do you go to? So we put out a citizen's handbook. You move to Rye and we've got something that explains This is how the boards work. This is how the town's structured. Towns and cities don't have that. The other thing, too, is I'm very involved in some of the nonpartisan groups, whether it be, you know, ranked choice voting or the people. But if you, you know, get off the show, it's like, all right, I want to do something. Where do you go? There isn't any place you can go to find out that information. So I put out a monthly newsletter called the Common Denominator Newsletter that's just, what are all these nonpartisan groups doing? So people, if they do want to get involved, know to where to go. So it's almost like a clearinghouse to do that. And a lot of the ideas I've had over the years, I put together a book, Consuming Government. And, you know, the point of the book is that the biggest thing we buy every year is government services, and we're irresponsible consumers.
Now, so let's look at what they are. Yeah, Stephen, this is great. And there's a lot from your call that I want to sort of digest with Dick and Quijada. And Dick, to you first, you touched on this earlier. Stephen makes a great point. You know, there is an information gap. I mean, in one sense, we're all overwhelmed with information, but he's right. In another sense, people don't really know what's going on or know how they can get involved.
No, with the Stephen, it sounds like in Rye, you and your neighbors are doing just what needs to be done. With the dramatic changes in media, there was a time, of course, you could open your local daily paper and you could read everything from the lunch menu from your kid's school to what's the zoning board doing and what's the local Lions Club doing and how can I participate? Obviously, things have changed a lot, but there has been a real explosion, actually, of local online news outlets, often run by volunteers and citizens, that's starting to fill some of that gap. Two things Stephen named that I want to address more on a little bit of on a statewide level. So one, the big changes in media. There is a terrific effort called the Granite State News Collaborative, 17 New Hampshire news organizations who are sharing their information. So it's kind of like the old UPI model. The idea is to enhance the quality and the accessibility of local and statewide news. And it's like a collaborative approach to journalism, including increased like Spanish language programming. So that's on a statewide level that the news outlets in New Hampshire, including NHPR, have recognized how much changing and are adapting fast. And I loved how you said to how do you have conversations across difference? How do you have difficult conversations? A program at CARSI called New Hampshire Listens, who now has years of experience in helping communities do exactly that, have difficult conversations about local issues that matter. They've done it on addiction, they've done it on law enforcement, they've done it on access to healthcare and other things. So there's some great statewide stuff happening. But honestly, some of the most exciting stuff we see is based in the communities, ground up, grassroots level, like we're here, like we just heard in Rye.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And Quijada, he said he saw this lack of civic health or declining civic health as a problem about 20 years ago. I'm glad Stephen raised that because, Quijada, this is not the first measurement of New Hampshire's civic health. So how does it look when you look back at past civic health reports? You know, has it eroded a lot or a little? Has it gotten better in some instances?
Well, it's a great question, Stephen, and it's so interesting to hear that you're feeling that at the individual level, because what you're experiencing is actually also a trend that we saw in our data in the Civic Health Index. So this is the fourth Civic Health Index that New Hampshire has conducted. The last one we wrote, my colleague Bruce Mallory and I wrote in 2012. And what we found from 2012 to the recent Civic Health Index is that trust in local government and national government, as well as trust in media and trust in neighbors, has all been on the decline. So you know, you're feeling that trend. The other interesting trend that we saw that Nancy mentioned when she was talking about her you know, people wearing their earbuds on the sidewalk, is that people in New Hampshire are strong in connecting with their immediate social circles, like their friends and family, but much less strong in connecting with their neighbors. So there really has been a turn inward in New Hampshire. And I think this echoes some national trends, and there's been a turn away from trusting our public institutions. And I find, you know, the question that was at, you know, I was really inspired to hear about the Citizens Handbook in Rye and the different efforts that you're making to increase access to transparency and transparency of information. My full-time job is at an organization called Public Agenda, in addition to me being a fellow at the University of New Hampshire. And some of the work that we do is looking at how we can make public meetings more engaging for community, because oftentimes the way that we hold public meetings is very rigid in structure, and honestly, it's boring, and it isn't how people want to spend their time. And a lot of the time they don't feel heard if they go to a public meeting. And so, you know, people feel like, what's the point in attending? Or they can't find the information to even attend. And what's really exciting, I just wanted to surface a couple examples in New Hampshire of where this work is taking place. So in addition to what's happening in Rye that Stephen mentioned in Pittsfield, New Hampshire, they actually created this program called Roundtables, Not Podiums, where the school board or town select board will actually invite people in the community in to learn like the A through Z of how it works and how people can actually use these structures. And then in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, they actually the city council actually changed their public meeting structure from always having public comment to alternating public comment and public dialogue so that people could dig into issues and really talk with their elected officials about the issues rather than just standing up at a microphone and saying their piece and not being able to have sort of an exchange back and forth. So I just wanted to share those examples.
Wow. Okay, Stephen, thank you very much for calling. And after a break, I have a bunch more emails that I want to share with both of you. Also, we can talk about what might be driving this decline in civic health and what might be done about it, to Stephen's point. Listeners, let us know what you think. Let us know with an email to exchange@nhpr.org or a phone call to 800-892-6477. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
I believe in a concept called pay it forward.
Stephen Randall of Northfield recently became a member of NHPR's Leadership Circle.
Because I realized the value that it provided to me personally. And so this is my way of making sure that this news source stays around for everybody.
You can join Steve and pay it forward when you give $100 a month as a member of NHPR's Leadership Circle. Learn more at nhpr.org/leaders.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, New Hampshire's civic health. According to the latest index, the Granite State ranks high in some areas and near the bottom in others. Listeners, join us. What do you see in terms of community engagement, social trust, volunteering, voting, and other indicators? What disparities do you see? And how much do you feel you can get involved in your own community's life? Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 800-892-6477. We're talking with Kihata Moore-Vissing. She's a fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy at UNH and co-author of the 2020 New Hampshire Civic Health Index. Also, Dick Ober. He's president and CEO of the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation. And Dick, to you, one of the findings that jumped out to me from this latest study is that New Hampshire millennials really were not deeply engaged in their community's civic life. And I wonder what you found there and what you make of it.
Yeah, it's a concern, especially as one of the states with one of the highest median ages. The imperative to create more ways for younger people to be deeply involved, we think about it really every day. And here's the millennials that I know, it's not that they don't want to be. In fact, some of the people that we hear from and that we see in the community are so deeply interested in being more engaged. And in fact, we hear from young people, 20s, 30s, 40s, early 40s that say, you know, I'm here partly because I feel this is a place that we can make a difference. So one of the findings that was positive in this report, generally New Hampshire residents feel they matter and they can make an impact. So we hear people saying, I had no idea that I might run into my legislator in the grocery store. I showed up at a Conservation Commission meeting to listen and was invited to join the Conservation Commission. So New Hampshire has this tremendous potential for people to be more engaged, to make a real difference in their community. And we have to be clear about where those obstacles are. In some cases with millennials, you have, they're working their jobs, they may be raising families. And to Stephen's and Quijada's point, they simply might not know how and where that they could become more engaged.
Another aspect of New Hampshire's civic health, Quijada, that you found New Hampshire scores very low on, in addition to this millennial engagement, is very few Granite Staters getting to know, connecting with, reaching out to people of different races and ethnicities. What did you find and why is this important, Quijada?
Yeah, so we ended up finding that New Hampshire ranks 46th in the nation in terms of people connecting with someone of a different racial, ethnic, or cultural identity than themselves. And what was interesting when I looked at this is I first thought, is this a proximity measure, just in terms of how much people are physically interacting with someone else? But it also looks at online interactions and interactions on the phone. I feel like this is a very alarming statistic. I will say that other communities, that other states that have large concentrations of white populations like Maine, Wyoming, West Virginia, also scored low in this. So some of this may be a proximity measure. And we do have a smaller population of people of color in the state in New Hampshire. But the reason that this is alarming to me is for a number of reasons. First of all, you know, I think that connecting across difference is critical to creating strong civic health in a community. But New Hampshire also demographically is very rapidly diversifying, particularly in the southern part of the state and particularly in youth populations. And we see that in some of our metropolitan areas like Nashua and Concord and Manchester and Dover and Portsmouth in particular. And you know, when you think about that combined with a couple of factors, I think that this really puts us at some risk for potential discriminatory behavior in the state. So, you know, one trend that we've seen nationally is that there's increasing white supremacy. And I think as a state in New Hampshire, even though we've always had people of color living in the state, we historically have identified ourselves as a majority white state. And so we don't have the infrastructure to really have much data about the experiences of people of color in the state. And we don't really have the history of navigating racial and ethnic differences in ways that, you know, other states in the nation, especially like southern communities or even like, you know, Connecticut or Massachusetts compared to New Hampshire have been doing for decades. And so I think we really need to put attention and energy into how can we get in front of this so that we are a state that is welcoming to all people and really, you know, can be a model of how to respond and evolve when we have different populations joining the state. And so one, you know, just a couple small things that I can recommend is that I'd love to see New Hampshire invest at the local level and the state level in more bridging opportunities where we're just getting people to interact with each other across difference, because I do think that is the first step in starting to learn how to successfully navigate racial and ethnic differences. And then the other thing I would say is that, you know, for our public officials, we need more diversity and equity and inclusion trainings so that we can be responsive to all of the people in our state.
Let's go back to the listeners. And Tom is calling from Chichester. Hi, Tom. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. I have a couple different questions and views. One of the things I notice in Chichester, anyway, is lack of participation from people in town. We've done everything from survey monkeys with the planning board to get people involved with some really important things on how the town gets regulated, and we'll get a response of 125 people. Now, when you have 125 people shaping your whole town, that can be a little on the scary side. And I don't know how, and it's like our town meeting, our school meeting, we had 55 people there to vote on $6 million plus on a budget. I mean, to me, somehow we got to get this stuff turned around. So I'd like to see somehow some tools to get people involved in this sort of thing, to kind of let it grow.
Wow. And Tom, what role do you serve in Chichester? You sound like you're involved in some way.
Well, I'm in the planning board and also the budget committee.
Wow. Okay. And well, this
is very deeply in all this stuff in town, actually.
Well, and good for you. And I really appreciate the call. And Dick Ober, you know, we've talked about this on the show before, a general lack of participation in town meeting, school board meeting, you know, 55 people voting on the school budget.
No, New Hampshire, there's a paradox about New Hampshire. There is a sense that things should happen at the local level. There's kind of an ingrained distrust of like big centralized decision making. And that means that so many decisions that affect our daily lives are actually made at the municipal level across our 234 towns. And if you're not feeling welcomed or you don't understand how to participate in that, your voice, sure, you might vote in a statewide election, a national election, but your voice on your local taxes, on your school board, what's happening in your schools, what's happening in land use planning is going to be absent. And I think there are good practices around the state. And as Tom was speaking, I was realizing, how do we create a better way for towns to continue to share what's really working? We mentioned before what's happening in Pittsfield. Pittsfield is one town that has really kind of completely reorganized the way it talks about and tries to address local issues. How could people in Chichester learn from what's happening in Pittsfield and so forth? You know, I also want to come back to the last conversation. The issue around young people and the issue about our growing diversity are really connected. This myth that New Hampshire is, you know, is all white. We have among the fastest growing proportional change in racial minorities in New Hampshire, and especially among young people. So as we think about wanting to engage more young people, we need to think about being more welcoming, to recognize what the obstacles are and the specific obstacles facing young people and all residents of color. Our shared prosperity is absolutely dependent on embracing and celebrating this increasingly multicultural, racially diverse state. And one of the things that we're pleased that Kiata has pointed out is we don't have enough data. So how can we disaggregate some of this data or go deeply to learn more? What are the specific challenges facing young people? So why are they not showing up in Chichester and being involved, and especially young people of color? And I have to say just one other thing. You don't need too many bad situations of a young person taking the time to show up at a public hearing, especially a young person of color, which is a brave thing to do, and either feeling unwelcome or actually being shown some harsh behavior and being shut down. And there are some of those stories, both in some things that have happened in the legislature and in local hearings. We need to really be honest about where those barriers are.
Tom, I'm really glad you called. A couple more emails. This one from Liz, who says, I suspect that many people who claim to, quote, not like politics or to, quote, not be interested in politics are actually not interested in partisan politics, Liz says. I suspect that some folks who criticize a thing for being too political might actually mean the thing is too partisan. Politics are everywhere. I wish that the political wasn't so often conflated with the partisan. And I wish also that the partisan wasn't so often reduced to a black and white either or dynamic. Thank you, Liz, for writing. Here's a related email from Paul, who says, I am very concerned about the civic health of this state. Paul asks, how do you have a realistic conversation with voters who embrace bald-faced lies and conspiracy theories? So Liz and Paul, thank you for writing. And, you know, Kihat and Dick, we got to tackle this head on. Politics has never been beanbag. I think that's the old saying. But Kihat, it's gotten kind of ugly out there. So how much is that affecting our civic health?
It's definitely affecting our civic health, absolutely. I think that, you know, at a very personal level, who wants to go to a meeting and get yelled at or to hear points of view that really don't resonate with your own point of view. I mean, I think that the volatility that we've seen nationally, unfortunately, is trickling down to our local communities. And I would say that the one thing that we can agree on across partisan lines is that no one wants to feel hostility in their community or unwelcomeness. I mean, that, you know, that's not comfortable, and that's not how we want to engage. You know, one trend to one of the points that people wrote in the email is that I think that the issue around news has really been exacerbated by something that some people call filter bubbles. So this is work that Eli Pariser and others have done, where we're reading news increasingly because of social media and the way that we consume news is that it's totally possible to engage with news just that sort of reinforces your point of view, and that unfortunately on both sides, you know, Republican and Democrat or you know the parties in between, it basically causes people to make it more difficult to sort of entertain someone from the other side. I think that this is a difficult thing, but the one of the solutions I see for addressing this in communities is that we just need low stakes ways for people to get together and know each other as people. And I think the more that we get to know each other as people in a community, we start to see across party lines and really start to look at the experiences of individuals, and that makes us more open to listening. So as a couple examples, I know in Nashua that Nashua has actually done a lot of work with community gardens to bring together refugee populations and old Nashua residents who've been there for generations to engage together just, you know, casually as they're working in the garden and they can get to know each other in that way. There's also a lot of national programs that we could emulate or bring to New Hampshire. For instance, there's a program called On the Table that just encourages, once we're able to get together in person again, that just encourages people to get together for dinner at a local restaurant in the community and talk about community issues and talk with people who you don't know. And then there's a program called the Ben Franklin Circles that actually doesn't focus on politics, but focuses on sort of life values and tries to get people talking across difference just about, you know, the ways that they want to live their life. So, and New Hampshire Listens, as Dick mentioned, is a organization that's done dialogue work across the state for some time, trying to build broader civic engagement. So I definitely think it's critical that we try to address this. And I think there's also some changes that we could make in the way that we structure engagement opportunities, where we just make them more fun, you know, instead of some kind of formal, very constricted engagement opportunity where people have to, you know, wait to speak at a microphone, that we're bringing people together over music or festivals. There's a lot of things I could say about that, but I'll leave it at that for now.
Yeah. Wow. And some of those opportunities you were talking about, Kihat, I'm thinking that sounds great, but pandemic, large gatherings, you know, all that stuff. So we can maybe dig into that a little bit after a short break. I have a bunch more emails too that I'm hoping to share with both of you. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
I listen to NHPR because it opens up my world.
Peg Hendel of Waterville Valley is a proud member of NHPR's Leadership Circle.
I really value the fair and well-researched and well-balanced information that I get. That's something I just had to support.
You too can join NHPR's growing family of Leadership Circle members when you invest $100 a month into the statewide news service you trust at nhpr.org/leaders.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, author and educator Jessica Leahy talks about raising addiction-resistant kids. Join us for that conversation tomorrow morning, live at 9. Today, we're talking about New Hampshire's civic health, where we do well, where we rank near the bottom, and we've been getting your impressions. Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests are Kihata Moore-Vissing at UNH, where she's a fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy. She's co-author of the 2020 New Hampshire Civic Health Index. And Dick Ober is with us, president and CEO of the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation. So here's a question that came in from Maddie. And Dick, I'll throw this to you, please. Maddie asks, what can we do here in the state to help improve civic health? It's a great question, Maddie. Thank you.
So, you know, our last conversation about increasing polarization and kind of the harshness of some of the rhetoric, the role of social media. One way I think about this is civic health is always seen as a really good thing that we should work on. It feels like an absolute imperative now because of some of the trends we've named today. The rise of disinformation and conspiracy theories, the ability, disability to even agree on facts, kind of declining trust. And so there's, to me, this is everyone's responsibility. In the report, I think this is obvious, but there's little things that everyone can do. I loved the comment before, wave to your neighbor. It's even harder when you're wearing a mask, you know, because it's hard to read expression. So I actually kind of double wave to people as I'm walking around with a mask on. Volunteering, participating in community decision-making processes. They're happening in your community right now. It's not always easy to find out what's going on where, especially in COVID and when these decisions are being made, but it is happening. There's a meeting probably today in your community about an important decision. Learning from different sources of news, try to break out of that bubble that Kihata said, and so much news we now get, which is then amplified, comes from social media. Expressing yourselves through letters to the editor, belonging to civic service organizations, finding a nonprofit you care about and giving of your time and talent. As you practice being more civically engaged, you will find, as we were talking about earlier, it makes you feel more productive, it makes you feel more a part of your community. And when we next do our check on our civic health, it will be the combined activities of everyone who lives in New Hampshire who's done a little bit more. On top of that, there are, you know, a lot of resources and organizations and initiatives. Kihata named some of the national ones, and many of those are playing out in New Hampshire as well.
Well, and speaking of sort of people reaching out and people getting involved, we got a couple emails from people talking about holding online meetings and what that has meant for engagement. Ellis wrote us, one thing to keep in mind is that 20 and 30 somethings are really busy with job, finance, housing, and family obligations. Going to where they are or offering something they need or want can help. Zoom has made meetings much more accessible, and family-focused events can engage busy parents. Ellis, I myself got engaged with a group over the pandemic that I never really had time to do before because it involved a half-hour drive. So yeah, there is that angle. Tim wrote, in my role as a selectman in a small New Hampshire town, I can report that there are far more many people in our public meetings now than when we saw before the arrival of virtual meetings. People that would not drive down to Town Hall at 7 p.m. can now participate from the comfort of their homes, and they do. Tim says, we will be having our traditional town meeting outside in June. So, Tim, thank you for writing. And lastly, here's another email from Melissa, who says, what do you think the pandemic will do to the future of civic health in New Hampshire? How will things change? Melissa, this is the million-dollar question, isn't it? And boy, Kiata, I want to hear from you first. And if you could fold in there some of the stuff that our other emailers wrote about, you know, in some instance, Zoom meetings have enhanced civic participation.
Yes, it's, well, we are at a very interesting time in history right now for civic life, as well as a range of other factors. And I think that we're really at a crossroads with the pandemic, where we might enter a civic renaissance, right? Where, as people are mentioning, engagement is up in some ways because we've had to innovate and reach people in different ways, which honestly is something that we should have been creative and thinking about before, but sometimes you have to have a push to actually take action. It could be that because people have been so socially isolated for the past year plus, and have realized the value of social connection, that you know, we have this civic renaissance where people want to be super engaged in their communities and connected and are willing to show up and do things. And now we have these different tools where we can reach people both online and in person. It could also be that the pandemic pushes us into a civic dark age where, you know, we already saw a trend before the pandemic in the civic health data that New Hampshire had turned inward and really wasn't connecting with its neighbors and broader community, but kind of keeping to its sort of most immediate social circles, friends and family. And the fact is that we have spent time either alone or with those intimate social circles for the most part for months and months now. And so, you know, the transition of actually re-entering community is not to be underestimated. I think it's going to be complicated for some of us and overwhelming. And so I think what I would urge our public institutions and community groups to do is to think really intentionally about, okay, how do we harness this energy that we have and really encourage people to you know, come back out and engage after they've been cooped up for so long? And how do we try to minimize the potential for people to turn really inward and not connect with their communities at all? And when you combine—
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Yes. Sorry.
Go ahead, Kihara.
I was just going to say, when you combine this with some of the national trends around polarization and the state's trends around polarization that we've been seeing, I mean, this isn't just you know, important for sort of feel good community building, but like, this is essential to the future of our communities, so that we're not living in fragmented, disconnected places.
Well, this relates to an email from Katie that came in, who served on her town council and been very active. Katie says, I hope that now we're getting vaccinated and starting to go out again, we will see the lack of direct civic engagement in 2020 as a blip, not a permanent decline. Katie says she finds hope with the engagement of young people, but what scares me, Katie says, is they will get discouraged by the acts of our elected officials. And Dick Ober, that raises a question I want to ask you. What is the responsibility of those in public office right now to pay attention to this, you know, as we re-engage, hopefully, you know, doing it right, as Kiata seemed to be saying, you know, don't blow it.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a, Kiata just named kind of two paths around civic renaissance or civic darkness. And there are things that have happened this year that are hugely positive. And someone named them a minute ago was the more and more public processes are being opened up online. In the past, you know, going to testify in a legislature or testify at a, or speak out at a local meeting meant you're finding, if you're a young person, a young family, you're finding childcare, you're finding transportation, they're not at convenient times. And what we are hearing is a lot more people are actually logging in and listening to statehouse hearings. We really hope and encourage that the state house and legislature continues to allow people to testify through remote means after the pandemic is gone. We've learned more people will be engaged, and it takes special skills to facilitate that well. Every time there is a public hearing, a public conversation, and someone who is in power says to someone who wants to be engaged, says something that is demeaning, it's not only turning that person or racist, it's not only turning that person off, that person is saying others, wow, don't bother. So people who are in positions of power now, select boards, legislature, school boards, our civic health, the next time we test our civic health, a lot of that could be based on how willing we are to really listen and change the way that we are trying to conduct our civil discourse.
Well, and Quijada, really briefly, and I do apologize for asking you to keep it brief, but what additional research or data do you need to give you an even fuller picture of New Hampshire's civic health?
Sure. So what we don't have right now is data about local civic health. We really only have statewide experiences. And so I think the next step is for local communities like Nashua, the North Country, you know, Portsmouth to collect their own data about civic health. And that will help us to really tell the story of what New Hampshire's civic health looks like at the local level and how we can continue to have a long history of strong civic health.
Well, Quijada, it's been really good to talk to you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
That's Quijada Moore-Vissing. She's a fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy at UNH. And Dick Ober, was really nice to talk to you too. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Dick Ober, President and CEO of the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation. Today's show was produced by Exchange producer Jane Hunt.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.